Well, here we are continuing on in chapter 9, and I've really been enjoying the section that we're in. I think it's just very practical. It's very practical to our life, talking about last week looking at, hey, how do we handle doubt? And today we're going to look at humility. Next week we'll be able to look at temptation, and we're just in this really practical part of Mark. Like we talked about earlier, Mark isn't rich with teaching. A lot of it is the narrative itself. And so now that we're in this little passage of teaching, it's really just one ongoing teaching that we're kind of in starting today. We've been able to see a lot of these good and helpful things. And so here we are today, starting in verse 30, and we're going to get the second of Jesus's death predictions, second out of three of them. And what we mentioned the last time when we got to the first one back in chapter 8, in verse 31, at the end of chapter 8, is that when he shares this, he says, you know, hey, I'm going to die and rise again. But then he goes from that statement about his death and resurrection, and he goes into, well, what does it look like to be a true follower? And the first time it was this idea of self-denial, that to follow me means you need to deny yourself and to carry your cross, to accept what might come to you, this humiliation perhaps. So that was the first one. And then today it's going to be, again, I'm going to die and be resurrected. And then we're going to look to this teaching on humility. And then the third one, he's going to go to servanthood. I think it's actually a pretty natural progression of self-denial to humility to servanthood. And we'll look maybe more at that in a complete unit when we get to the third prediction. But that's where we are today. So I'm going to read for us Mark chapter 9, starting in verse 30, and I'm going to go through 41. And that'll be our passage for today. So, Mark chapter 9, verse 30. They went on from there and passed through Galilee. And he did not want anyone to know, for he was teaching his disciples, saying to them, "The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And when he is killed, after 3 days he will rise." But they did not understand the saying and were afraid to ask him, "Who is the greatest?" And they came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, "What are you discussing on the way?" But they kept silent, for on the way they had argued with one another about who was the greatest. And he sat down and he called the 12, and he said to them, "If anyone would be first, he must be last of all and servant of all." And he took a child and put him in the midst of them, and taking him in his arms, and he said to them, "Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. And whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me." John said to him, "Teacher, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him because he was not following us." But Jesus said, "Do not stop him, for no one who does a mighty work in my name will soon afterwards be able to speak evil of me. For the one who is not against us is for us. For truly I say to you, whoever gives you a cup of water to drink because you belong to Christ will by no means lose his reward." Okay, well, there's our passage for today. Let's go up and see what's here in the text itself. And then, like I said, at the end, we'll kind of circle back to this idea that I think Jesus is driving at as far as what are his followers and what do they do. So it says there in verse 30 that they were passing through Galilee, but that he didn't want anyone to know. This is actually the last time that they'll be in Galilee in Mark. At this point, they're going to head on down. We're going to get this teaching in chapter 10. Then they're going to head on from there, head to Jerusalem. And when we get to the beginning of chapter 11, that is when we are starting Passion Week. And they won't be leaving Galilee until, or leaving from Jerusalem until after Jesus' resurrection. So here they're in Galilee, and it says they went to the house, probably. It doesn't say absolutely, but most probably. We're at Peter and Andrew's house, the very same one they first went to back in chapter 1, verse 29. And it's kind of been their home base in Capernaum during their Galilee ministry. So they kind of quietly pass in, and they just head to the house so that he can focus on his apostles, on the 12. We've been mentioning that really since that point in chapter 8, when we kind of had this great moment where Peter declares that you are the Christ, and they've been on the road, that this has really been the training camp, if you will, for the apostles. He's preparing these men for what would be to come. So here they are, they're in the house, they're in Capernaum. They don't want anyone to know. They don't want the crowds to come to him. He just wants to focus on them. It says, you know, he didn't want anyone to know, for he was teaching his disciples. This is the whole purpose, is so that he can focus on them. And there he gives us his death prediction again. And again, using the title, the Son of Man. He says, the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And when he's killed, after 3 days, he will rise. Now, when we go back to chapter 8, in verse 31, and we read his first prediction, we see that he was going to suffer, that he was going to be rejected, killed, and then rise again. Here today, though, we get this new part. He's going to be delivered up. Now, this idea of delivered up is really, in a sense, a legal term. But it also holds a lot of Old Testament implications, too. In the legal military term, it would be to hand over. If you were to say delivered up in our kind of thinking around our court system, we might say that moment where you're delivered up is, you know, you've been arrested, you were in jail holding, and now you're coming into court for the first time. You're being delivered to the judge, in a sense. You're being brought before the court. You're now in that setting. But I'm going to flip us back to Joshua real quick. This is Joshua. This is Joshua 10, verse 8. I'm just going to read it for us real quick. It says, "And the Lord said to Joshua, 'Do not fear them, for I have given them into your hands. Not a man of them shall stand before you.'" So when we see in Joshua this word that we're kind of translating to give, delivered up into their hands, sometimes you'll even see it as like betrayed. That word that we're using, when we see it in the Old Testament, when we look back, what we're seeing is always this notion of God's enemies being placed into either God's hands, or that God has placed the enemy of the Jewish people into their hands, that they might have victory, that they might be successful. And so that's this notion of being given up to. You are fully in control of the person of whose hands you've been placed in. It's not even just the Old Testament, though. We can even see it in the New Testament. For example, in 1 Corinthians 15:24, we read this. "Then comes the end, when he delivers the kingdom to God the Father, after destroying every rule, every authority and power." So at the end of days, again, this word that we're translating is delivers, handed up. At the end of days, Jesus is going to take all of the world and place it in the hands of the Father. It's all going to be subdued, all placed in his hands. So the question is, who's doing this delivering up? There's kind of been two possibilities that people have thrown out there, and I think that Scripture makes it clear. The one that I don't believe that it is, even though you can make the conclusion it's not entirely wrong, is to say that Judas is the one who's going to be doing this delivering up. Again, he does do that. He does take and hand over the information of where Jesus is so that he might be arrested and taken. However, in Romans chapter 8, verse 32, this is what it says, and I think it gives us a clearer picture of just exactly who's doing this giving up of Jesus. It says in Romans 8:32, "He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us, how will he not also with him graciously give us all things?" So again, that gave him up for us, same word that we're translating as delivered, handed over. "And he who did not spare his own son," so God, "who did not spare his son, handed him over." The whole point here of what Jesus' prediction is that this was God's plan. This isn't just Judas messing up the situation, but rather that God had intended from the beginning that he might hand over his son so that his son could be the sacrifice. So we can see here just what Jesus is saying. That this is the plan, that I am going to go and be rightfully handed, not betrayed, but handed up so that I might be at the mercy to be rejected, as he prophesied, by the people so that I could be the offering. So that's his prediction here. But in verse 32, it says, "But they did not understand the saying and were afraid to ask him." This confusion is going to continue every time he says it. They're not going to quite get it. It's in John, at the resurrection account in the Gospel of John, where John finally gets it. He realizes, oh, all of those scriptures about and prophecy about Jesus rising from the dead, this is it. Let me read to you in John 20. John 20, verse 8, it says, "Then the other disciple who had reached the tomb first," that's John, "also went in, and he saw and believed. For as they yet did not understand the scripture, that he must rise from the dead." So all the way up until it's fully fulfilled, they don't quite get it. Their idea of the Messiah is so wrapped up in the one who's going to go to Jerusalem, conquer the kingdom, kick out the Romans, take over the world, and put the Jewish people on their place as those who are overseeing the whole world through their Messiah who reigns over the world. That's their idea, and we're going to see that. We're going to see that play out in the rest of our passage today around what they're talking about. That's where their mind is. So all of this, you're going to die, be handed over, rise again. We don't get it, Jesus, whatever. Yeah, you're the Messiah, so we're just in to follow you. I appreciate that heart, but it leaves them scratching their heads. It says they were afraid to ask. We don't know exactly why. Maybe it's just because they're afraid to be rebuked like Peter was the last time. But here's what it says in verse 33 as it continues on. It says, "And they came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, 'What were you discussing on the way?' But they kept silent, for on the way they had argued with one another about who was the greatest." So as they were headed there, as they were leaving where they were further up the Jordan Valley and heading to Capernaum, you know, Jesus has kind of overheard them arguing, and he asked them, "Hey, what was that you were arguing about back there, guys?" I've got a hunch that he probably already knew and was looking to have a conversation about it. And they play that card like you're a scared little puppy who knows they've done something wrong. "Hey, what were you guys discussing?" And they go quiet. We kind of mentioned this before, but it's actually in this passage in Matthew where we can see that these guys are actually teenage boys other than Peter. So back in this account in Matthew, if we read in Matthew 17, 24 to 27, there's a little interjection that's not in between 32 and 33 here, where they're in Capernaum already, and Peter's approached about the temple tax, and they say, "Hey, have you and your rabbi been paying the temple tax?" So Peter goes back to Jesus, they have this little conversation, and then Jesus says, "Okay, well, here's a coin. You go find this fish. In the fish's mouth, you'll get a coin. That's the temple tax for me and for you." Because the tax was half a shekel. So here's one full shekel that covers me and you. But here's the thing. Jesus only says that's for me and you, just the two of them. Only people over 20 had to pay the temple tax, which means the other apostles are somewhere in the range of 16 to 19 years old. So when we say that these are teenage boys running around with them, we mean it. These are young men, and I don't know, I was one, I know, but if you spend much time around teenage boys, it's herding cats sometimes. And here, Jesus says, "Hey, what were you guys doing?" And they go quiet, because what they've been doing is arguing about who's the greatest. Again, we're headed on into Jerusalem here, and they know it. And if Jesus, the Messiah, is about to become the king of the world, boys, that makes us numbers 2 through 13. We're in good spots. And who's the greatest? I mean, okay, you know, Peter, James, John, they're the ones who always get to go with Jesus. So probably one of them. And they're just trying to sort it out from there. It feels so much like a conversation you'd hear between young boys, young men. I mean, even today, like, we can't talk about great performers in whatever their category is, great athletes or musicians or artists. We can't just say, "Oh, wow, they were great." Then we need to compare greatness to greatness. Who's the greatest? We have to know. These guys are no different. But here's what Jesus does. So he asks them this. They don't reply. And then he says in verse 35, it says, "And he sat down and he called the 12. And he said to them, 'If anyone would be first, he must be last of all and servant of all.'" So he takes the position of a rabbi. We can see in every gospel, whether it's in Matthew 5, Luke 5, John 8, this is what rabbis did. When they go to teach, they don't stand like me before a pulpit. They sit and they call their disciples in to sit with them. And so Jesus, he takes the posture of teaching and now he's going to teach. So when we start here from this point on, and then going on for a good ways into chapter 10, this is one teaching that he's called his apostles in to sit under. And he starts us off by redefining greatness. Okay, you want to know about who's great? Here is the definition of greatness. The one who's last. The one who's a servant. Totally opposite to every notion that we have. Again, this is the idea that we're going to circle back in, this idea of humility. And so we're not going to rest in it here. We'll come back to the end. Let's continue on through the passage, and then we'll come back to see what exactly is this statement that Jesus makes. To make this statement, though, he uses a child. He uses a visual analogy. It says in 36, "And he took a child and put him in the midst of them. And taking him into his arms, he said to them, 'Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. And whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me.'" Now, for us, there's just a little bit of context we want to put our minds in. Because we live in a world that has been changed by Christ for 2,000 years, we see children as these precious, beautiful things. When a child is born, we say, "Look at this miracle of new life." That's not really the case in the ancient world. Think about what you might know of the ancient world. Of the Spartans, who, if your child had any deformities, any single one, take him up to the hill and leave him. Think of the Romans, who were very, very much so caring about keeping your family tight. The more kids that you have, the more that has to spread out. Most of them don't make it. Until your child's 6, 7 years old and you are confident that they're not going to perish as a young child, they're kind of there. We don't see these precious, beautiful little 3-year-olds the way that we see them, as these sweet little innocent people. Now, hear me clearly. God is unchanging. He has always loved his creations. That's not what I'm saying. I'm talking about the culture in which they're living in. So when Jesus calls over a little child and says, "When you're a servant of him, that's when you're serving me," that's big. A child is not only just someone you're not serving, it's something you're ignoring. There's the little kid in the corner of the room, whatever. But now, if you want to be great, you're not going to just pay attention to the child, you're going to serve him. And he lays this important notion that we want to see. Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. And whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me. When we love his people, we are loving him. He calls us to do that, to be seeing people with his eyes, the way that he sees them. We can't go and say, "Oh, you know what? Yeah, that little kid, kind of beneath me. Somebody else will help the kid out. I got bigger things to worry about, adult things to worry about." We can't say, "Oh, yeah, that friend of mine who's just perpetually causing problems for themselves, they need to handle it themselves." Because think about that in reverse. If we're to love with the same love that Jesus showed us, if we're to have the same eyes for others that he had for us, does he not see us perpetually causing problems for ourselves and yet still offer us sacrifice? Does he not still offer us grace? Is his spirit not still here burdening with us, even now as we believe in him and still fall into temptation? We have to do the same. We have to see everyone with his eyes. In verse 38, it says this. John said to him, "Teacher, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him because he was not following us." If you remember, just last week, the guys had failed to cast out a demon. So now here's someone who is successfully doing it and not in their ranks. They're a little sore about it. "Hold on. We're your guys, Jesus. What do you mean other people are special?" Here's what Jesus says. But Jesus said, "Do not stop him, for no one who does a mighty work in my name will be able soon afterward to speak evil of me. The first thing I want you to see is, I'm going to read for us really quickly from Numbers 11, 26 to 29. This is just a real short story of Moses, and he's in a very similar situation. See how he reacts. This is Numbers 11, 26 to 29. Now two men remained in the camp, one named Eldad and the other Medad, and the Spirit rested on them. They were among those registered, but they had not gone out to the tent. And so they prophesied in the camp. And a young man ran and told Moses, "Eldad and Medad are prophesying in the camp." And Joshua, the son of Nun, the assistant of Moses from his youth, said, "My lord Moses, stop them." Sounds just like the apostles. Here's Moses' reply, though. But Moses said to him, "Are you jealous for my sake? Would that all the Lord's people were prophets, that the Lord would put his Spirit on them." Well, that's what we live in now, that the Lord has put his Spirit on us. Moses didn't see that and say, "Oh, hold on, I'm the only one who's supposed to be able to do something from God. I'm the special one, not you." His desire would be that everyone would get that. And now for us on this side of the cross, we do. God has poured his Spirit out on all who believe. And Jesus, what he's saying here to these apostles is, yeah, you guys, you have a special calling. I've got something for you. It doesn't mean you're the only ones. And he goes on to say that someone who does a great work in his name, how could they possibly slander against them? Think about it. Think about sitting there and praying from the bottom of your heart deeply for a miracle. That a friend or a family member is sick and you don't really believe. You wouldn't have called yourself a Christian, but you don't know where else to turn. You've seen your friends and family that are believers, and you've seen the way that prayer works for them, the peace that they have. And so in your heart, you take a grasp at desperation and you pray to the Lord. You pray for a miracle and you see it. You see it fully and it's undeniable. How could you sit there and then turn around and say, "Oh, curse Jesus"? You couldn't. Your heart's going to be changed. And so Jesus says that. Hey, apostles, a man who's out there, as he says, affirming this miracle power, that this is happening, a great work's happening in my name, bring him in. Don't kick him out. He's only going to be able to praise me more and more. He continues on. He says, "For the one who is not against us is for us." Now, if you remember, it almost sounds a little contradictory to something we heard back in Matthew 12:30. It says in Matthew 12:30, "Whoever is not with me is against me, and whoever does not gather with me scatters." So that almost sounds opposite. How do I sort that out? I think if we think about it for a second, though, what we'll see is he's just saying there's no gray area. You're in or you're out. If you are with me, you're with me. And if you're against me, you're against me. You can't be in group A and group B. So here in Mark, when he says in verse 40, "For the one who is not against us is for us." Again, there's no gray area. You're moving with God or you're moving against him. And then lastly, in verse 41, he says, "For truly, I say to you, whoever gives you a cup of water to drink because you belong to Christ will by no means lose his reward." So I think what we can see is once again that we're called to go and act for others in his stead and see them in his stead. That we take on the love and the heart of Christ and we bring that to others. And we do that because when we see others, we see him. If we looked at others and we saw them with our own eyes, to see the way that we see the world, we see broken people. We see people who have hurt us. We see people who are foolish. When we see people with the eyes of Christ, we see those who are chained in sin, those who need to be saved, those who deserve, not out of themselves, mercy and grace, but who deserve mercy and grace from us because we've been given it when we don't deserve it. So what ought we to do but to turn around and give it? This notion, this idea that we see others and serve them, if for no other reason than because we see the image of Christ in them, that they were made in the image of God, and so we love them for that. That's what we're called to. And it even gives us a reason for all of this. Hey, if you can't just get on board with all of this just simply because I said so, then see this. Here's a reason to live in humility. That there is a reward. Look, I won't skirt around it. I am still human. I appreciate knowing there is something working for. And when he tells me, do not lay up my treasures on earth, but lay up my treasures in heaven, when he says here there is a reward, what I can know is there is something waiting for me in heaven. Don't know what it is, but what I know is this. If God is calling it treasure, that's what I want. Whatever man calls treasure, I've seen that. It's going to pass. It's going to rust. It's going to fade. I don't know what exactly my reward looks like, but I know if it's what God is calling a reward, that's what I want. And that's what I'm going to work for. And I'm going to store up as much as I want. I'm not looking to have riches in this world. I don't want that. I want riches in that world, and I want it in abundance. And what I'm called to do in that, it seems, is to serve his people and to live a life honoring him so that one day I might enjoy whatever the fullness is that he has for me. I don't think we're selfish for desiring what God has for us. I think it's worthwhile to pursue the riches of heaven, whatever they might be. So as we kind of look back at just the text itself, what we can see here is that Jesus has once again prophesied that I'm going to pass. And for you, when I die and rise again, to be my followers, this is what it's going to look like. And he goes on to begin teaching them. We're pausing here in our teaching, but again, as we continue and pick up next week at verse 42, it's the exact same conversation. He's preparing these disciples for what's going to come. That these young men are going to lead his movement. And they need to understand the core characteristics of who he is and the kingdom that he's trying to build. And here, humility is one of them. So with that in mind, let's turn back to this notion of humility with the time that we have left. He declares that the last is to be first. Forgive me, I cannot help myself, but all week long when I was thinking through this, the quote in my head was, if you ain't first, you're last. And Jesus directly speaks against that. If you ain't last, you'll never be first, he says. If you don't serve all, then you are actually at the bottom. It's completely opposite to what might come natural to us. Again, in our world, there is a level of desire for humility. And it's only because our world for 2,000 years has lived pursuing a more godly and Christ-like world. The church has changed our culture. And so we do see humility as a virtue. Humility was not a virtue at the time that Jesus is speaking. In the Greek mind, the Greek philosophy of the culture, man is the measure of all things. How great are you as a man? How high can you be lifted up? Will the generations after you speak of your name? Will you be remembered? What greatness can you do? What can you bring to our group? So for you to willfully lower your own measure, it's unthinkable. For you to say the thing by which I am valued in this world, my name, my pride, no, I'm just going to reject all of that and put myself at the bottom. That's not how the people thought. Now we can see back in the Old Testament, that is what God has called us to. He tells us in Micah 6:8, "O man, what is good? And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God?" Or he tells us in Isaiah 57:15, "For thus says the one who is high and lifted up, who inhabits eternity, whose name is holy, I dwell in the high and holy place, and also with him of who is contrite and lowly spirit, to revive the spirit of the lowly, and to revive the heart of the contrite." So in the Jewish law, it is the humble in which God is going to walk with. But in the culture of their world, humility is not something to be desired. And yet Christ says it's his very nature. When he tells us, take my yoke. Why? Because I have a humble and lowly heart. I'm gentle. It's in his very nature. In fact, he tells us in the Sermon on the Mount, he says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Twice. It's those who are poor in spirit. It's those who are meek. They're the ones who are going to receive fully. That's what we're called to. This idea of humility, this idea of making oneself lower is difficult for us to grasp. Even now. Even in a world that does say humility is good. You should try not to go and boast all of the time. You should try not to always be one-upping people. We do value that. But the root of humility is not based in the right roots. The root of humility in our culture is that we don't want to shame somebody else. We don't want to make them feel lesser than. We don't want to idolize ourselves. That's not what we're trying to do. The root of humility in the eyes of Christ is so that we can better understand what he's done for us. Charles Spurgeon would often say this quote. He would say, humility is to think rightly of ourselves. And I think paired with this quote from Luther where he says, God created the world out of nothing, and so long as we then are nothing, he can make something out of us. Where are we rightly? If we're to take Spurgeon's quote, how do we rightly think of ourselves? We're dust. God had nothing and made everything. And then out of that made us. We're dust that he put life into. Why do we have value? Him. And why do we have value in this life now, born again? Him. It's to see and to recognize that we are where we are because of him. To recognize that in us, death. In us, brokenness. In us, failure. But in him is so much more. It's to think like this. We get to respond to his call. When he says, you're a servant, we then have two choices. No, I'm not. I'm a captain. So you just let me know where I'm going to be in charge, and I'll start bossing people around. That's what I'm for. We could have that response when he calls us to that. That we think more of ourselves than he ever did. Or we could take it in humility and we could say, yeah, I'm a servant. I don't even deserve to be a servant. To be a servant is so much, in your house, Lord, is so much greater than anything I ever could have brought for myself. To be your representative, Christ, to go to someone else and to show them love so that they might say that I saw the love of Christ in me is more than I would ever deserve. That someone might see me and my actions in my life and think of Christ. I couldn't ask for more. But to do that, we can't be proud. To do that, we can't be dragging our own name to the heights of the heavens. To do that, we have to be humble. It's the kind of leadership that says, no, I'm not going to get behind you and drive you with the whip. It's the leadership that says, I'm going to get in front of you and I'm going to pull the sled. Follow me. It's what Jesus did, and we're called to be his representative, to emulate that. In Philippians, the verse that we have in our sheet today is Philippians 2:3, but to read a larger section, here's what we can see. Philippians 2, starting in verse 3. Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit,
but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to his own interest, but also the interest of others. Have this in mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. And being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. So if you're standing there thinking, I'm too good for this, God chose to become man and die. You're not greater than him, so you have no excuse. I want to give you just nine ways here that we might be able to create a humble heart, some practical things that we can do. I think the first thing that we can do, the most chief thing that we can do, is we can reflect on the cross. We can think about what he's done on the cross. We can think about that verse right there from Philippians, that he humbled himself and took on the cross, and he did it for my sake when I didn't deserve it. I think that we can also not only reflect on the cross, I think we can take captive our time specifically for the use of other people. I'll give you an example. Every week I drive to St. George. Not every week, every other week I drive to St. George. On that hour and 45 minute drive, I could just drive and listen to some music and think about nothing. Or what if I took captive that time and said, okay, well, I'm stuck in this car. I can't read a book. I can't. These are things I can't do. What can I do? I could call people. I could encourage people. I could use this time to call and pray with people that I know need it. I can take captive my time for the sake of other people. I'm intentionally looking at my own time, something that is a finite resource in my life, and choosing to use it and to plan to use it for the sake of other people. The more that we do that, the more it's going to create a heart that is looking to be humble, of thinking of others first. Here's another one. We can reflect on the cross. We can take captive our time. We can recognize the means to our ends. How is all of this happening? Sit and contemplate it. Hint, not us. It's not us. When I sit and I look and I think, oh man, we finally, we're enjoying some precipitation that we've needed. I didn't make clouds. God did. When I sit and I look at our new deck over there, I didn't go build that. Our church provided funds to go purchase materials and to pay a laborer to put together a deck, something that we needed. That wasn't us. That was the heart of this church. Doesn't matter what we do. You look at anything, realize that ultimately, however long you need to draw down that chart, we're not the source. Here's another thing that can create a humble heart for us. We can invite correction into our life. We can be willing to say, hey, I'm not perfect. And if you see me misstep, bring it up. I'm willing to change. I know that there are rough edges on me. We can also study the Word. The more that we see His nature and His plans, the more that we understand just how short we fall of that. That the measure of this world is not man, but the measure of this world is Christ. And when we stack up to that, we fall short. We can also cast our cares upon him. This is what it says in 1 Peter. 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 6 and 7 say this: humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, so that at the proper time he may exalt you. So how do we do that? He tells us. How do we humble ourselves? Casting all of your anxieties on him, because he cares for you. So how do we create a humble heart? We cast our cares on him. I'm not the one who can solve this. You are. You have my worries. You have my concerns. You bring the solution. I'm going to walk forward faithfully in this. And lastly, well, and really three things, but I think we can begin and end our day doing three things. When we wake up and before we go to bed, we can acknowledge our necessary need for God. We can wake up every day and realize, God, I am drawing breath because you've put it in me. And we can go to sleep saying, I'm resting my head because you brought me through this day. We can express our gratitude to him in our prayer. Thank him for the things that he's done. And we can worship his goodness, whether it be with songs of praise or just simply in prayer, speaking those same praises. So those are some things that I think we can just practically do that will create a humble heart for us. At the end of this, we can look back and say, all I have is Christ. All I need is Christ. And all I want is Christ. I don't need more fame. I don't need more power. I don't need more glory. I don't need to be in charge of this group of people. I don't need people singing my praises. I just want Christ. I want him. I want him in my life. I want him in my heart. And I want to see others with his eyes so that they might have the same joy that I have. And when we do that, I think it leads us ultimately to a place of humility. And I think it ultimately comes out of a place of humility. Let us pray.